This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Martial Law in Pakistan, the Imperial Crisis Deepens. On Saturday, November 3rd, Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf declared emergency rule. He suspended the Constitution, fired the country's Chief Justice, and took extraordinary steps that gave him absolute power. Within moments, army rangers were on the streets of Islamabad. By Monday, over 2,000 opposition figures had been arrested and Supreme Court justices placed under house arrest. The over 30 privately owned television stations across the country were cut and strict rules were placed on newspapers. Let's look at some of the rights that were suspended in Pakistan. According to the Associated Press on Sunday, November 4th, protection of life and liberty, the right to free movement, the right of detainees to be informed of their offense and given access to lawyers, that is habeas corpus, protection of property rights, the right to assemble in public, the right to free speech, equal rights for all citizens before law and equal legal protection. And media coverage of bombings, militant activity is curtailed. Broadcasters face a 3-year jail term if they ridicule members of the government or armed forces, specifically if they in any way criticize President Pervez Musharraf. Today on Taking Aim, we are very fortunate to have with us Masood Alam, the BBC correspondent in Islamabad. Masood, good morning.
Hello. Good morning to you.
Masood, good to be with you again. I'm grateful to you for coming on, and we want to continue the dialogue that you and I had in Islamabad some months ago. Please, Masood, the numbers that are being given to us, about 2,000 people under detention being arrested, reports, in fact, BBC's reports and Washington Post indicate that this may be but a dramatic understatement of the number of people who have been detained. Can you fill us in?
It's really hard to put a figure on all the arrests all over the country. Because not all the arrests have been reported. We know of some figures where the people were, they were important people or visible people. So we got to know of them. There are workers, political workers, and there are human rights activists, and there are people working with NGOs who have been picked up, and we don't know of them. So yes, it's really difficult to put a figure on it, but it is in thousands.
And Masood, the magnitude of the repression occurs with the compliance of the armed forces in general, does it not? And the question at hand is the role of the established political parties in mobilizing in opposition and resistance on the ground. What are the prospects of a serious struggle against this arbitrary rule?
Well, it's been fairly, if people were expecting some kind of leadership in this situation, they've been fairly disappointed because the, one of the biggest parties, Pakistan People's Party, Benazir Bhutto, who has just arrived in Pakistan after she was in self-exile for good about 7-8 years, she's just come back. And she was expected to take up a leadership role, but then there's this talk about Washington brokering a deal between Benazir Bhutto, this leader of People's Party, and the President Pervez Musharraf, General Musharraf. Whatever the details of that deal are, we don't know, but this is established that there is some kind of understanding between the two of them to share power. Now, in this situation where even elections are in doubt, the Prime Minister himself yesterday expressed doubt that elections can go ahead as planned, which was in January next year. In that case, Benazir is probably weighing her options right now. It was the emergency was put in place on Saturday evening. This is Monday evening in Pakistan now. And we have not heard from her. She was supposed to come into Islamabad today, but then she changed her plan at the 11th hour. So, and we have not heard from other political leaders. Yes, we have interviewed them. The other leader in exile is Nawaz Sharif, who is the leader of Muslim League. We spoke to him. Yes, they all condemn whatever is happening, but no one is actually spearheading a campaign on the street. Get people out. Be heard. No one is doing that. The civil society, by which I mean non-governmental organizations, human rights activists, they are the only ones who are doing something, and they are also being arrested. And yesterday, the worst example, or best way you look at it, the former head of the Human Rights Commission, Pakistan, he is an 80-year-old gentleman, very well respected, has no political affiliations, has always been upright about everything, and they just picked him up and locked him up. So the way things are going, really, there hasn't been a proportionate response to them.
Included among those detained was General Gul Hamid, the former head of the ISI, the Inter-Service Intelligence, comparable to the intelligence services in the United States. Could you address why General Gul Hamid himself would have been arrested?
Well, I, for that matter, I couldn't even tell why the gentleman I just mentioned, Ayer Rahman, very well-respected gentleman, who, I mean, an 80 years old gentleman. I mean, how can he be of, how can he endanger this government or anyone for that matter? General Hamid Gul is a very vocal man. He's come out very vocally against things that he does not believe in or things that he believes in. He speaks very, very vocally. Not myself, but one of my colleagues went and spoke to him when he was in, when he was just been taken into detention. And what he told us was that he went to deliver a bouquet of flowers to the judges who had refused to take oath on this new PC or provisional constitutional order, which is basically replacing the constitution of Pakistan right now. And those judges who refused to take oath on it, he went to deliver that bouquet, and the police personnel just picked him up from there and put him in the jail.
And what
that's what he told us.
Right. What you're referring to is that immediately after the declaration of the provisional constitutional order, the military rule, that is what General Musharraf had done, is as the chief of staff of the army, he had declared emergency rule. And he did this as the chief of staff of the army rather than declaring martial law as president, the newly elected, you could say, by his ruling party controlled parliament. As president also. And seven of the justices, Supreme Court justices, immediately Saturday night had passed a resolution that would have declared the PCO illegal. And what he did...
Actually, it was not a resolution. Sorry to cut you off.
Yes.
It was not a resolution. It was a verdict. It was a judgment, interim judgment, on a case that was filed by a lawyer a day earlier. So it was a proper judgment on that case.
Thank you for the clarification. And what he did was he immediately removed them from the bench. Isn't that so?
Right.
And
right.
Yes. And then what he required was the justices as throughout the country to declare allegiance to the PCO.
That's right.
And so
that's right. And 14 out of 19 Supreme Court judges have not taken oath on that PCO. Only five have, including the top four judges are not included in the have refused. The top four judges have refused. In total, 14 out of 19 Supreme Court judges have refused to take oath.
And this
and the
is
same is true for.
And the same is true.
And the same is true for high courts also, where huge big number has refused to take oath.
And this is throughout the country when you're referring to high courts. You're saying throughout the country the judges were required to declare an oath of office under the emergency rule, and most are resisting
this. There is only one exception in the Balochistan province. There were only five judges, including the Chief Justice, and all five of them took oath. That is the only exception. Otherwise, in all high courts and the Supreme Court, the majority did not take oath.
I'd like to address a little bit the leadership of lawyers, attorneys, in the resistance to martial law. The lawyers had announced that there would be a countrywide strike on Monday. The statement of Hamid Ali Khan, the former president of the Supreme Court Bar Association, was, "We will launch our struggle tomorrow." This was made on Sunday, on Monday, and lawyers will hold rallies throughout the country. And in fact, they did. And according to the New York Times, 150 lawyers were arrested in Lahore after what they termed a, quote, pitched battle between police and lawyers who stood on the roof of the high court, throwing stones at the police below. Some of the lawyers had bleeding heads as they were shoved into police vans, and some fainted in the clouds of tear gas. In the United States, we don't normally find lawyers on the streets and leading the resistance. And I would like if you could address the leadership of the lawyers in Pakistan in this struggle against emergency rule.
Well, neither have we seen lawyers on the streets in Pakistan until now. But this is really something extraordinary. It's unusual. Really, the way they handled their last movement, which was a few months ago when Chief Justice, the same Chief Justice of Supreme Court, Chief Justice of Pakistan, was removed and there was a case brought against him. And the way it was done, the entire lawyer community, regardless of the political affiliations they had or religious affiliations, they were all united, and they took the message to the people saying, listen, this is the man who is charged with dispensing justice for all, for everyone, including the president's prime ministers, other judges. He is the man who is supposed to be dispensing justice for them. And if injustice is being done to him, and if you don't speak up, who will ever care for you? Who will ever dispense justice to you? And the message did get to people, and people came out in hordes, really. I mean, In Pakistan, even political leaders have been unable to bring out hundreds of thousands of people, which is what they generally, ideally, politicians pull out. Still, in this part of the world, they pull crowds in millions, but they couldn't in those circumstances. In the last 7-8 years of military rule, which is it's a democracy, but. A military-led democracy, let's put it this way. And in these 7-8 years, all the traditional political norms have been eroded, really. But this man, without speaking a word, I mean, he was not supposed to because this case was still sub judice, so he couldn't speak to people about the case. He would just go to the bar association, the lawyer bodies, and he'll just speak about legal issues, general issues, which is as Chief Justice is supposed to do. But people would go in millions.
Masood, let me address here a particular point. We were discussing the arrest of Gul Hamid. Now, Gul Hamid, having been head of ISI, after the attacks of September 11th, 2001, the World Trade Center attacks, Gul Hamid gave an extended interview to Arnold de Boer's grave of United Press International, in which he elaborated upon the fact that the intelligence services of the United States and the Mossad were the instruments of the engineering and implementation of the events of September 11th. And he gave a particularized account of his own experience in ISI in conjunction with Central Intelligence to sustain that advocacy. He's never ceased to elaborate upon the role of the United States military and intelligence services and those of Israel in instigating the events of September 11th. He has never ceased to declare his opposition to the subordination of Musharraf to the United States and its designs in the region, not only with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan, but with respect to Pakistan itself. In that regard, I just want to cite a report by the BBC from Karachi, Ilyas Khan, in which the report stated that the militant events that are ascribed to Al-Qaeda and what have you, with respect to the report, a vast majority of the republic suspect that the, quote, militant threat, unquote, cited as one of the reasons for emergency rule, has been engineered by the state itself. With such a crisis of credibility, General Musharraf will be looking to the same two factors of support that helped him survive in office despite his earlier conflict with the Chief Justice. The first factor is Western and, in particular, American support. The reaction from Western capitals has been cautious, but stopped short of rejection of what analysts call the second coup by General Musharraf. Gulhamid had been indicating these relationships, which may have much to do with his arrest, but what about the merit of what he has been stating? Namely, the role of Musharraf as an instrument of general imperial policy in the region, not only with respect to Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan, but with respect to the potential dismemberment of Pakistan itself.
Well, there is a section of population in Pakistan, and by that I mean those with religious bent and those with extremist religious ideas, and particularly living along the Pak-Afghan border. They have been either indoctrinated or they have reasons to believe, but they believe that America has designs to take over parts of Pakistan because they feel that those people feel that we are the pure Muslims, together with the Taliban of Afghanistan, we are the pure Muslims, and Musharraf is helping that American agenda of letting them take over this part of the world and run it according to their own plans, by which America wants to stop any more attacks coming from this part. Now, General Hamid Gul is one of the those people who actually not just espouse this ideology; they even preach it. And he has a good number of followers, really, especially in the religious community. This is something that's been on for quite some time, and it's gone to the extent now it's when people go out and recruit the people for jihad or for suicide bombings or for bringing people onto their side, this is probably the biggest point. Listen, if you don't come with us, you will be ruled by Americans very soon, and they will not let you keep your Muslim ways.
Masood, in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, an article called Economic Growth Clad in Military Garb by Stephen Kotkin describes the book called Military Inc., with which I'm sure you're familiar, by Aisha Siddiqa. Yes. And in this, the description occurs as follows. A military-industrial complex as part of a regular economy, as in the United States or Britain or Indonesia or Pakistan, demonstrates that military business operating in the shadows essentially has control. From 1950 to 2000, per capita income tripled in Pakistan, but social indicators like infant mortality and literacy remained at the world's lowest ends. A few hundred intertwined families rooted in the military maintain a chokehold on the country's wealth and political system. And in this description and discussion of the role of the military in relation to the intertwined handful of families, a few hundred, as essentially having total control and hegemony over the economic life of the society, is rooted this dance between military rule, arbitrary control, and what has been widely reported in the United States and elsewhere, the orchestrated arrangement whereby the very corrupt Benazir Bhutto and her husband would provide the legitimizing fig leaf of cover for Musharraf and the military in Pakistan. After all, Benazir Bhutto backed the attack on the Red Mosque. Islamabad Lal Masjid Mosque, which was an all-out army assault upon the people in the mosque and the surrounding area. Where does the working population of Pakistan, the trade union movement, the workers, the mass movement, if you like, factor into this dance between the political parties that are in collusion with Musharraf and the American plans to stabilize essentially a military-industrial control of the society?
Well, you see, to be in mainstream politics, by which I mean the bigger parties, parties that have some say in who forms the government, only parties that survive and get to the point where they actually have so much strength in the parliament that they can dictate what kind of government is formed, those parties have already co-opted army. They are sold on the idea that no political party on its own can survive in this country without help from military. They have actually accepted it. Pretty much every political party has accepted the fact that army is always going to be, if not entirely the ruler, at least part ruler of the country. Now, there is this this privileged club then, of which army is a permanent member, and other political parties, they kind of come and go. In this kind of situation, yes, there are labor movements. Yes, there have been talks of socialism and Islamic socialism and distribution of wealth, but it's mostly just to cater to this educated class, which stands in the middle and can't make up their mind. It's basically this morsel is thrown at them. Listen, we are a standard, normal kind of a country doing a normal kind of a thing. But the fact is, no one has access to what the military spends. The parliament cannot ask a question on military spending. The budget, the military budget, is not produced before the parliament. Aisha Siddiqui herself admitted that she couldn't get all the information that she wanted because it's such a secret. They don't want to share anything with anyone. And that is why there were also threats against her, that she had to go away and spend a few months running around in Britain and European countries, because she had so many. I was invited at her book launch ceremony here in Islamabad, and it was going to be in the afternoon, and that morning she was running around asking, well, they have canceled the venue. They have asked the venue owners to actually throw out my event. And now I have no place to go. And then finally friends and friends of friends, and they found a place. And at the last minute, everyone was told, oh, well, don't go there. Come to this venue instead. And this is how the book launch was performed. So the military, it guards its secrets, especially monetary secrets, very well. And this was the first major attempt at, if not bringing everything out, at least bringing something out in the open. And I'm sure there's a lot more work to be done in establishing that, yes, military has an empire, and it has such a huge empire that you can't even bring it down without really bringing everyone in the country together.
You know, I was struck by what you were saying now with respect to her efforts, because even with regard to the information that she's able to command, it's overwhelming. Her rough figure for the overall scale of what she calls MILBUS, or military business, is about $20 billion. And she gives specific examples of how that $20 billion translates: security-related businesses, hotels, shopping malls, insurance companies, banks, farms, airlines. She writes that the major civilian politicians have colluded in MILBUS and profit politically and commercially. And interestingly enough, Masood, the Wall Street Journal account of this quotes Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the leader of the Muslim League in British India and the founder of Pakistan, as stating, quote, "The future of our state depends greatly on the type of education we give to our children." And the Wall Street Journal concludes, "He was right, but education in Pakistan is an elitist affair in the extreme, steeped in national security demonologies, which has delivered the nation into the hands of a military cabal. The upshot has not just been political instability, but economic growth without development for the population." Coming from the Wall Street Journal, that's a fairly crystal clear description of the structures of power, which parallel those in our own country here in the United States, I must quickly add. But with respect to the crisis that has overwhelmed Pakistan at the moment, and I should report here that in our press, Musharraf's martial law has been done, notwithstanding the hand-wringing with Washington's complicity. Could you address the question of how in Pakistan an opposition to this can unfold without the control over parties that are in collusion with the process?
Well, it's really difficult to pinpoint. Like I said before, my personal opinion is that no political party can even imagine to be in power independent of the military. They always think in terms of, well, you use the word collusion, or you use the word partnership, or you use the word strategic partnership, whatever. But they always think that the civilian government, the civilian politician, is not really confident enough that he or she can run a government, run a country on their own. They always think in terms of in taking the army with them. Because army, like we've been talking about, they just have guns. They also have money, they have power, and they have access. They have access to places. We have been told that a number of times in Pakistan's history, the prime ministers and presidents have been kept in dark about certain things, about the nuclear project, for one, about the Kargil war, for another. There have been a number of incidents where the president or prime minister came and said, "Listen, but the army never told me this."
You mentioned, could you explain, you said the nuclear situation, that is the development of a nuclear bomb, but also you mentioned another, the Kargil. What was this?
Mm-hmm. Kargil was, it was a border skirmish which actually escalated pretty much into a full-fledged war with India. Kargil is, well, the Kashmir part is, it's both Pakistan and India have the claim rights over this territory called Kashmir, and this place, Kargil, sits right on top of that valley. So really, both the armies, Indian and Pakistani armies, have been guarding their own side of the border, their own side of the what's called a line of control in Kashmir, vigilantly for decades. Now, it was in, don't remember the exact year now. What Pakistan did was...
Excuse me, wasn't it in 1999 that General Musharraf was in charge of the events of Kargil, and it was actually the events of the... fighting in Kargil that led to his coup?
After the Pakistani army surrender under U.S. pressure, enormous pressure.
There was President Clinton at that time who actually brokered that deal. But the prime minister, civilian prime minister at that time was Nawaz Sharif, and he came out and he told the public, "Listen, he never told me that he was going to go and wage a war there. I never knew anything like this." And he went to President Clinton and he said the same thing. "Listen, my general is misleading me. He's never telling me anything. And so please don't blame it on me." So it's very funny. It's very funny for a situation. And it has happened a number of times, really, that the president or the prime minister, who's supposed to be running a country, ends up talking about being kept in the dark by the army.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Martial Law in Pakistan, The Imperial Crisis Deepens. We have on the line Masood Alam, BBC correspondent in Islamabad, Pakistan. Masood, returning again to the topic of the army. The Australian, on November 5th, Bruce Loudon, their South Asia correspondent, published a report, Army May Not Fall in Behind Musharraf. And they state, senior diplomats in Islamabad reported dismay within sections of the army, with speculation centered on the recently appointed Vice Chief of Staff, Ashraf Kiani, who is believed to favor a return to what they call democracy. Lieutenant General Kiani worked closely with Ms. Bhutto when she was prime minister, and they are said to have maintained good relations. Could you comment on this report by the Australian? And also, on the internet, there were false reports that actually a sector of the army had arrested General Musharraf.
Actually, I was going to mention this. This is part one on is pure speculation, and part two today it was pure rumor and nothing else. And I think one feeds off the other. I really can't say anything about General Kiani or what his way of running the army would be. All I know is he's known to be a very professional officer, known to be a good professional. And so far, he hasn't really said or done anything that makes him. And especially, I mean, he didn't. He wasn't really favored over someone else. He was the logical successor of General Musharraf, because the next two officers after General Musharraf, they were retiring. They have already retired, and therefore General Kiani was the next person. And because he's known to be a good professional soldier, he was to succeed anyway.
What now, you're referring what it to does. Here is, for some of our listeners may not be aware, that a crisis, the primary crisis in Pakistan, is that General Musharraf contended that he could both be president and the Army Chief of Staff, that is, to be the head of the civilian as well as the military sector of society. And this was the case that was that led to much of what is occurring in Pakistan, was the insistence that he stepped down as the chief of staff of the army.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And that is when he came out and said, okay, this is my successor. And after the election, which is going to be, which has already taken place, the presidential election has already taken place, but the results, the Supreme Court had ordered the results not to be made official until it hears a case challenging General Musharraf's nomination as head of the state.
And what our listeners may not be aware of is that the election, he was elected president by members of the parliament. This is not a popular election as in the United States. And that in January, the parliamentary elections were to take place. And the question was whether the Musharraf-sponsored parties would gain the majority and again have him be elected as president by the parliament.
Well, the issue, Maya, too, Masood, if you would elaborate upon this, is the desire of Musharraf to retain his role as military chief commander while also functioning as president. And one of the aspects here of the broker deal between the people, the PPP of Benazir Bhutto and Musharraf, was that Bhutto was to provide a fig leaf of civilian legitimacy for the continued military role of Musharraf. The complicity of Washington in all of these arrangements may be illuminated by the fact that both Pervez Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto have supported Pakistan territory being utilized by the United States military and intelligence services for its planned attacks on Iran. There are detailed reports about the Pakistani regime facilitating the plans for the U.S. military to use Pakistan to prepare for its war with Iran, not only conducting military exercises in Pakistan, but staging cross-border attacks on Iran, which have been ongoing but would be expanded, as reports in the American press have made clear. So the somewhat shaky understanding between the PPP and Musharraf after the sham presidential election of October 6th, under which the PPP basically broke ranks with the rest of the opposition and in that sense lent legitimacy to Musharraf's basic destruction of the Constitution, that raises questions as to the assassination attempt on Bhutto and 140 to 150 people killed. What are the elements involved in this? Bhutto identified four principal individuals. She didn't name them, but by implication, they were also associated with Musharraf himself, who in a certain sense has been comfortable with legitimizing the PPP, even though it may be the predicate for his remaining in power. In all of this, the people of Pakistan are left in the lurch, whether it's the PPP alliance with Musharraf or Musharraf without them. So the question that is before us now is what comes after the emergency powers? Who can sustain a resistance to these plots against the Pakistani people, indeed the nation of Pakistan?
Well, that is, as you say, it's a million-dollar question, really. Let's see each party's options here. General Musharraf really did not have an option. He has to stay in power because if he is not in power, he is liable to be hanged. That is the constitution of Pakistan that says what he has done by taking over, trampling our legitimately elected government, and by installing himself as head of state, he has committed treason, high treason, and he can be he can spend the rest of his life in jail or be hanged. Now, he has to stay in power, and to do that, he had to look around and he had to look for people. He generally found people who were either disgruntled or some of them really like him or they really like his policies, but a number of them, and prominent among them, among the politicians who are siding with him right now, they had criminal charges against them. So what General Musharraf offered them was, well, if you are in the government with me, well, forget about those charges. Some of his closest ministers, cabinet ministers, there are serious allegations of, we are talking corruption, we are talking murder, we are talking kidnappings. The party in Karachi, MQM, the biggest party in the Sindh province, its entire leadership has been charged with very, very serious, heinous crimes, kidnapping for ransom, murdering. And they are part of this government. Now, General Musharraf had all these people with him, and he was running the country. He managed it quite easily for so long. But then this time, it's really America's insistence. Somehow, American policymakers feel that the problem was in Afghanistan. Well, guess what? We think now it's over the border. It's in Pakistan. And the Pakistani leaders, none of the leaders we've had has been strong enough to actually do something about it. Neither is Musharraf. Well, he is the army chief, so he's fairly strong. He's stronger than other civilian heads of state. But he's still not strong enough to do what we expect him to do. And when they're talking, from the point of view of the United States.
Masoud, it's very instructive because at one point in his speech, when he appeared on national television just before midnight Saturday and delivered this somewhat rambling 50-minute exposition of his decision. He cited Abraham Lincoln, and he stated that Abraham Lincoln had broken laws, violated the U.S. Constitution, and trampled individual liberties to keep the country together. Interesting from our point of view, because most recently, Massoud, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Pace, when he was retiring, gave a speech in front of George Bush and Secretary of Defense Gates and 300 leading Pentagon military functionaries and officers, in which he stated that the public in the United States has no right in any way to voice or vote opposition to the wars that are being launched in Iraq and beyond by the United States military. And Pace declared that the only legitimate discourse is how those wars will be won and how the military will be supported. His successor, who was present, echoed these sentiments, and then Bush issued an executive order in which those who oppose economic policies, not just military, but economic policies of the United States with respect to Iraq and Iran, Pakistan, and the region, are subject to having their property confiscated, their bank accounts seized, the clothes off their back taken, without entitlement to recourse, due process, or attorneys, and those who might assist them, for example, their cousins or their brothers or their office mates who would give them $10 when they were to buy some gas, would be subject to the same penalty. What's unfolding in Pakistan is not far from what is planned in the United States. Let me be quick to point out to our listeners, as people in our country are increasingly aware. Musharraf declaring emergency rule in Pakistan is not so much in defiance of the United States as implementing the requirements of rule for the likes of Musharraf.
It's rather interesting you brought up the subject. General Musharraf likes to call himself a liberal, and he likes to stand on the left of center. President Bush is on the right. And yet, they have so much in common, especially when it comes to getting your agenda through, getting your agenda across. Whatever it takes, if it takes, well, they, both of them clearly do not consider individual liberties as something sacred, really. They can be trampled whenever needed in the name of bigger, larger interests, which is national integrity or national security. General Musharraf has been going on and on about national security for pretty much everything he has done. Most of the time, it's not about national security, like in this case, what he's done declaring emergency in Pakistan. He started, when he was elaborating his reasons, he started by saying the militancy is on the rise, suicide bombings on the rise. He counted two, three, four, five reasons, including economic downturn. And then, in the end, what he did, all the actions included in that order, the PCO, pretty much all the orders, they are aimed at silencing or intimidating the courts, the lawyers, the civil society, the Human Rights Watch just came out with a statement today, and this is what they've said. They've said that General Musharraf has used the militancy and used militancy in the northern parts of the country to actually harass and intimidate the civil society of Pakistan. So it's pretty much working in the same way. In America, a lot of liberties, individual liberties, were taken away after September the 11th. People in those, when they are in a shock, when something big is happening, and they can't really, and they have to trust their leaders that whatever decision they're taking must be in the larger good of all of us. And therefore, people in America didn't put up a lot of resistance to all the restrictions on the liberties that were introduced systematically, gradually. So exactly that is happening in Pakistan. In fact, there is a bit more resistance here to General Musharraf's actions than we saw in America.
And what I think is amazing to return is the role of the attorneys or the lawyers in this, and the role of the judges who are saying that habeas corpus, for instance, the right to be of detainees to be informed of their defense and given access to lawyers, is a bulwark of a democratic society and actually of any society. And one of the prime points of General Musharraf was his objection to the Supreme Court releasing so-called terrorists who had not been charged. And the court had ruled that if the state was going to hold them, they had to be charged with an offense. And I'd like to know how you think resistance can unfold, and if you think that General Musharraf will take similar actions as was done in Burma, where even access to the internet is cut off.
Well, he almost went as primitive as that when he shut down all the news channels in the country, Pakistani or foreign channels, all of them. They've been shut for, 48 hours now. What's interesting is you just mentioned the detainees. Well, we call them missing people. Missing because there are no reports. Their families don't know where they are. All they know is, well, one day someone picked them up, took them somewhere, and they've been missing for months, for years. This man, the Chief Justice, Iftikhar Mohammed Chaudhry, he was really very passionate about the issue. And he said, well, you can do whatever you want, but their families have to know their whereabouts, and you have to keep it fairly open. Or if you want, you know, you can have some time. Well, for 30 days, I can interrogate this person without making his whereabouts public. But then at some point, after a limit, you have to bring him on. Now, this was a very sticky point, and General Musharraf did mention it in his speech to the nation. But then the other thing, what he said was that the courts are freeing these terrorists, and these terrorists then go out and carry out these attacks which kill so many more innocent people. Now, guess what? Yesterday, which was a day after delivering this speech, Pakistan government has released 28 suspected terrorists, some of whom were charged with string of terrorist attacks and their association and their affiliation with these people. And they have been freed in exchange for more than 200 soldiers who were kidnapped more than 2 months ago. So it's a barter deal. It has happened yesterday. Now the government has done what they were charging the courts to be doing.
It's interesting.
But the courts,
yes, please.
But the courts at least have a process. They at least have a procedure to follow. Here there were no questions asked. Someone just decided to release these people. Now they're going to go back, and they're not going to go back and say, well, we have done enough and we're not going to do any more. If they're terrorists, they are going to be continuing to terrorize people.
Well, the question that we always pose in the United States with regard to this business of terrorism is, who are the real terrorists? Because the question is posed by the role of state power, the fact that the acts that are imputed and ascribed to quote-unquote terrorists invariably turn out to be government operations themselves. Let me mention here that in the light of this extraordinary crackdown on the media, large numbers of arrests, lawyers, human rights activists, opposition parties, and their leaderships, nonetheless, the lawyers have called for a countrywide strike today. Quote, we will launch our struggle and lawyers will hold rallies throughout the country, Hamid Ali Khan, former president of the Supreme Court Bar Association, declared. What's the dynamic of the strike? Will it spread? Will other sectors of the population respond? Are the lawyers attempting to link up with broader sectors of the population in the efforts that are made. The arrests that are taking... Masood?
This is Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. We were speaking with a BBC correspondent in Islamabad, and the lines have been cut. We will continue for the last few minutes without Masood.
Well, we are going to check on Masood, who, as our brothers and sisters, imagine yourselves in the circumstances in which Masood Alam finds himself, and then understand the courage it takes for him to speak as he does with the clarity and the honesty and the directness of his report from besieged Islamabad.
We should mention again that all international, that's BBC, CNN lines, were shut down in Islamabad, and 30 independent television stations were closed. The military went into the offices of the largest newspaper and shut down the presses as the newspaper was going to print the morning edition. We have recorded this program on Monday, November 5th, for broadcast on November 6th. By then, we know that there will be many more events happening in Pakistan. Again, our program today has been Martial Law in Pakistan, The Imperial Crisis Deepens. We will follow it in the next several days. And we were speaking with Masood Alam, a Pakistani who is the BBC correspondent in Islamabad. Ralph, do you want to sum up in the last couple of minutes?
Well, I want again to express our appreciation to my friend Masood Alam, with whom I have been in close contact since we met together in July, as I had with Gul Hamid and others. Let me say this, brothers and sisters. We are giving you a live, lived description of martial law in practice in Pakistan, the mass repression that goes with it, the collusion of the established parties. As in Pakistan, so in the United States, brothers and sisters, every aspect of the martial law that is unfolding in Pakistan has been promised to us and is indeed within the architecture of the fascist state that is in rapid preparation within our own country. This is an international struggle of the oppressed. In the outlying subjugated areas of the world, they echo what we ourselves will confront in the near future, brothers and sisters. We will continue with the discussion of martial law in Pakistan, the authorship from the United States, the instruments of control, and how this affects our lives and the future struggle within our own country.
Yes, I'd like to mention, Ralph, when we talk about martial law in Pakistan, that the arrests, the detentions are going from the very base, the human rights activists, all the way up to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court justices who refuse to state their allegiance to the provisional constitutional government that Musharraf has declared, this emergency rule, they have been under house arrest, and reporters and people have been blocked from visiting them. They are surrounded by the military. Lawyers have been arrested. There have been, by Monday, there were over 2,000 arrests, primarily of attorneys and civil rights activists and leaders of opposition political parties. And the struggle will continue. The people of Pakistan will resist this emergency rule. Again, this has been Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman.
Ralph Schoenman.
Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Martial Law in Pakistan, The Imperial Crisis Deepens. Sorry, Ralph. We had been speaking with Masood Alam, BBC correspondent in Islamabad. We were speaking with him by cell phone. The lines have been disconnected with the BBC and CNN. And we will continue next week with an update of what has been happening. You can find our program archived at www.takingaimradio.com, as well as on the WBAI program archive. And you can contact us at takingaim@pacbell, that's PACBELL.net. We'll be with you next week.
Tatan tatin da karo tatan.